Yeah, that's why 2020 and 2021 was not fun for us. It's we felt dragged into doing all sorts of unnatural things, and as you said, those shotgun marriages of situations where founders and VCs met. And then, like a day after, you need to make a decision because there's another, 10 term sheets that come. Those are now turning, not surprisingly, to be challenging. Sometimes they work out because, you just lucked out in having a good relationship, even though you didn't really have a time to date beforehand. But most of the time, I think they're turning out to be pretty challenging.
Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today we'll have a look at Matt Turk's and Firstmark Capital's recipe for success. Matt built and sold a venture back in the years, I would say. Was then the managing director of Bloomberg Ventures, from built it in the beginning, and then 10 years ago, it's a while, moved to the New York-based venture firm Firstmark. You invested in companies like Pigment, Ledger, Synthesia, and many more. You're also known for the Matt Report, which is a look or taking a look at the landscape of machine learning, artificial intelligence, and data ventures, like overall the ecosystem. And yeah, what should I say? I'm super happy to have you here in Berlin. So thanks for taking the time, stopping by. Welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Thanks for having me. Excited for the conversation.
I should say that now you're also a podcaster, and so we're sharing a bit of the same traits. I have a first question that I think is super super interesting because there are a lot of podcasts that people can and should listen to when they want to know a bit more on the backstory, and I think there are a lot of good interviews done already. So that's why I want to dig in a bit deeper. The first thing because. I met Adam, one of your partners in New York, and we talked a bit about the hype cycle in 2020, 2021. I then talked to a lot of VCs here throughout the years and met a friend of mine, David Roskam from Magnetic, earlier today. And he was like, yeah, I think what Firstmark is doing very well is they're investing very concentrated and very thinking about, like, not doing too many deals per partner, a different investment philosophy than we have it here in Germany or in Europe very often. So let's break down investment philosophy a bit. So how are you thinking about being a venture investor?
Yeah, so at Firstmark, we practice venture capital in a way that is almost traditional, which was definitely not the cool thing to say 2 or 3 years ago, but very quickly it's becoming cool again. And by traditional, I mean that we have that model where, as you said, we don't do too many deals a year. It's very much a high conviction, low volume kind of play. But when we do invest, then we sign on for years of service. On the whole, we tend to be lead investors. We come in typically at the Series A, sometime at the seed, and then we have a fund structure that enables us to double down at the B, at the C, at the D, at the E. We have one of those opportunity funds structure that's coupled with a core fund that enables us to do that. And it's very much that model going back to the old days of Silicon Valley of really trying to be a partner to the entrepreneur. As corny as it may sound, that's really the model. And we found that it's just hard to do if you do too many new deals a year. So having said that, it's behind the scenes, it's a little nerve-wracking to do that kind of style of venture because you keep saying no to opportunities, some of which are really exciting, but you have to focus on a few, and then you're in a constant state of oh, was that the right decision? You have like FOMO on some. Companies that you could have invested in and really liked, but you again, because you cannot do too many deals a year, you said no to, and it's hard, but it's in our opinion one the best way to generate great returns for our LPs, and two at a personal professional level, just love that style because it is truly that hand in hand partnership with entrepreneurs that people talk about when they talk about the good aspects of venture capital.
How many deals do you do in a typical year?
So in a good year, I'll do 2 Series A's, and then I'll probably do...
In a bad year, it's 3 seeds.
2 seeds. Well, it's actually a really interesting point that you're making. I mean, we're not the only early stage venture firms in that situation, but we found ourselves in the crazy years 2020 and 2021. Sort of struggling to do Series A's because the valuations were so high that in reality they were Series B's, except with, you know, Series A or actually pretty often seed metrics. And we didn't do a lot of those. In fact, as I'm racking my brain through trying to think of like one we did, there were very few. And then we came down. So we started doing a lot of seeds. And when you look at our most recent fund, the proportion of seed versus Series A is much higher than we were anticipating. And look, as a VC, you need to adapt to markets. And in our case, we are reasonably disciplined around valuations. That's what happened. So... now that the market seems to have shifted back, and we can talk about this, but in my opinion, it's a lot more nuanced than it seems, we are starting to do a lot more Series A's again.
I think one important thing that you mentioned is managing FOMO and getting used to it and having it, but also embracing it and saying, okay, that's still what I wanted to go for. And I think that's also very important for a lot of founders. This can be on the current AI cycle and the hype cycle that we had in 2020, 2021, and so many other things. Like, there are so many opportunities for founders all the time. So that they also have to think about, how are you personally managing the fear of missing out and figuring out what you're actually focusing on and what you really want to do rather than what you could do?
Yeah, so in general, I think there's something beautiful about the power of constraint. The fact that you cannot do everything should be a feature. It's certainly not a bug. And that's true for VCs, but as you just alluded to, that's true of founders. From my perspective, founders ultimately are, in a way, in a similar business as venture capital, which is capital allocation and time allocation. And doing less tends to produce better results over time. And it's been actually something I've really enjoyed in the last year and a half, which otherwise has not been the most enjoyable period of time. But one thing I did enjoy is the fact that in all the companies I work with, the fact that cash became more of a constraint has had the almost immediate consequence of drastically narrowing down the focus. And across all the companies I work with, all the projects that were kind of not mission critical, possibly side projects, a lot of those just went away. And again, across all the companies I work with, there's a sense of focus, which is really enjoyable. And, you know, lo and behold, it turns out that with great focus, you can see great results, acceleration in product roadmaps, product development. And I find it personally very refreshing.
I would say in 2020 and 2021, I didn't feel that, for example, for VCs, money would be a constraint. So, but I also talked to Adam when I was in New York, your partner, and then he told the same that you did, that you did not make too many deals in the, let's say, Series A deals that were from the valuation side, Series B's, and at the same time, seeds that were Series A's, like too crazy. So he mentioned some numbers. On the one hand, I forgot them. On the second hand, I'm not sure if they should be public, but that the average was like super high, but your average was definitely a way lower from the deals that you did. And so as a company, because I can imagine that it's super easy to still get hyped up because everybody's doing deals. Everybody is sometimes writing checks after like a few days and instead of spending weeks and months. And of course, it was very efficient for the founders, but at the same time, very dangerous because they don't actually know who they took on. So I personally imagine that it's super hard to stay true to your core while everybody else is doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah, that's why 2020 and 2021 was not fun for us. We felt dragged into doing all sorts of unnatural things. And as you said, those shotgun marriages of, situations where founders and VCs met, and then like a day after you need to make a decision because there's another, 10 term sheets that come, those are now turning, not surprisingly, to be challenging. Sometimes they work out because, you just lucked out in having a good relationship, even though you didn't really have a time to date beforehand. But most of the time, I think they're turning out to be pretty challenging. The combination of not really knowing who your VC is, plus a more difficult environment. I think, now that we're actually, in my opinion, just starting to get into the problematic zone, that's not going to turn out to be great. So again, I go back to that traditional venture aspect. I've just in the process of doing a Series A now, meaning that we are between the term sheet and closing, and that took several weeks. In the entrepreneur was actually trying to slow down the process. I was trying to preempt the deal, and they didn't let me. Instead, they said, "Well, we'll have an organized process in a few weeks." And I was not happy about it because obviously that meant that the price was going to be higher and the likelihood of getting the deal lower. And I did feel strongly that I was the right partner, but, to their credit, or at least that's very much their right to do so, they decided to have a process. And the whole thing, probably took, 3-4 months. But the good news is that I had many more meetings with them. And, it feels like exactly the right decision to be working together and have a clear sense of where I'm, what I'm getting into. I was joking in 2021. I think I tweeted that. I can't remember the exact words, but I think I said the first board meeting is the new due diligence, meaning the first board meeting after you do the deal. And it's sort of what it felt like, for a lot of those deals. So anyway, I think we back to what venture should be, and I think that's very good for everyone involved.
What should founders actually look for? Because I think a lot of founders are just used to what happened 2-3 years ago and don't really ever, because they got their pre-seed, they got their seed and maybe a preempted Series A, they maybe also forgot what it actually is to fundraise and what they look for in a partner. From your perspective, what will you say founders should actually look for?
I think first and foremost, you need to look for a partner that truly understands and loves what you do. And doesn't do it, doesn't invest in the company, thinking of the company as an asset, but much more someone who is in the venture building business and can commit for many years. So that's, first and foremost. I do think that everything else being equal, people with experience tend to be better. So I'm saying everything else being equal, because sometimes people with experience are completely flat out, don't really have bandwidth, are on a million boards, and will not have enough time in reality to dedicate to you, except if you're the next Facebook or Figma or Snowflake. But everything else being equal, look, it's like all things, right? Whether you believe in the 10,000 hours principle or not, but especially at the Series N beyond, when that person is going to be a board member, most likely, you want somebody who has been on boards for many years and has seen a whole range of situations, because people tend to be better after they've done it many years. It's pretty much as simple as that. And then, you know, look, on top of that, there's all the things that one can sort of like assume and imagine. Certainly, brand has an impact. The, you know, a firm with a good brand will be better at creating a halo effect around the company. By the way, good brand doesn't necessarily mean the brand that everybody knows. It can mean a really good brand for what you do specifically. So if you're in the logistics business, VC that has a deep specialization and a good brand within the logistics industry is going to be as great as, you know, a generalist VC firm. And related to that, we at Firstmark believe very much in the concept of platform, and we have a very full-fledged effort there. So look, platform is the thing that used to be kind of like new and different years ago, and by now every single VC is going to tell you that they have a platform, and look, some do. But there's a whole spectrum of what that actually means. So I can talk about what that means for us, which is that basically half of our team is focused on post-investment support, which in our case means three things. One, the creation of networks and expertise that is available to the companies in the portfolio. So that manifests through a lot of events we do. That manifests also through what we call guilds, which is a series of private invitation-only communities for CTOs and CFOs and CMOs. We have one on AI that we started recently that enables professionals in each one of our portfolio companies to have a home where they can learn, where they can network, where they can connect with peers. So that's one. Two, corporate introductions. Or that's you know, something we've been doing for a very long time. And look, there's no genius to it, but the beauty is that we're in New York, and New York is the place where all the customers are. There's a very impressive concentration, as we all know, of large global 2000 companies. Either they are headquartered in New York or they have a large office in New York. So look, we don't do that just in New York, but being in New York really, really helps. So, you know, we've been pounding the pavement for many years trying to get to know all the people in media and pharma, obviously financial services, and all sorts of companies. You know, the government, Washington, D.C. is not too far. So we have a deep network and we help making introductions there. And last but not least, talent. And, you know, we have people doing this full time. And again, look, there's no genius to the concept of having people that do talent recruiting on the team, but we've learned through many, many years of the trial and error what works and what doesn't. And at this stage, we have a lot of best practices and processes around how to do this well. So, you know, it's just working because we've been doing it for many years and I've learned, again, what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think a lot of people say that they have platform teams. A lot of people say that they're a good partner, and then so even if they do hundreds of deals, I would say, like, that's very, very, like...
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's like, you know, to say something that's maybe obvious to everyone and basic, yes. So one, a lot of VCs will say those things. By the way, you know, as much as I like making fun of my own profession, VC on Twitter and all the things, I do think there's a lot of VCs who are very good, very well-intentioned, do great work. I'm on, you know, a number of boards with people that I really like and respect, and are actually totally not the caricature of the VC that you hear on Twitter, but like very, very good, smart people. A lot of VCs will say, well, thanks. So, like, you know, do your work, do your research, talk to other founders. Certainly, if you are lucky enough to be in a situation where you have several term sheets and different VCs competing for the privilege to invest in your business, speak to other founders in their portfolio, the usual standard thing to ask. And again, maybe like everybody knows this, but if not, let me mention it. You should talk to not just their base companies, but also companies that did not work out, and get some information about how those VCs handled difficult situations. And I do think, having said all that, for any given company, there is not an infinite number of VCs that are right for you. So be selective. Again, all the things I said, do they really understand your industry? Are they really committed? Do they have the time? Do they have the experience? Do they have the brand? Do they have the support networks? Once you draw all the circle, the sort of the Venn diagram intersection is pretty narrow.
Yeah, fair enough. One thing that I really loved when I researched and listened to a lot of podcast interviews is that you said that you for a long time really wanted that the CEO is very technical. And especially in a country like where I'm from, Germany, where a lot of founders are very business heavy. And of course, we have a lot of great universities and we have more and more ventures founded there and stuff is happening. But a lot of founders and CEOs are often very business heavy and maybe into product, but also that is not always given. But you said you changed your mind a little on it, that you said, okay, you're accepting the business founder a bit more.
Yeah. So look, that statement very much comes from the fact that the vast, vast majority of what I do as an investor is reasonably technical. So on the whole, I'm much more of an enterprise investor. Actually, I'm would say 90% an enterprise investor. With a particular predilection for the world of data, machine learning, and AI. So that's what I've been doing for many years now. For that type of business, and I do it both at the core infrastructure level all the way to the application level, on the whole, it makes more sense to have technical founders because those are technical domains. Having said that, I think there is something really interesting about technical founders, which is a whole maybe different conversation, because what again may seem obvious, but something I've learned over the years is that building a company is really like building a machine with different parts that need to work together. So there's a concept of systems, and I found that people with a technical background tend to naturally think in terms of systems. So that has worked pretty well. So separately from that, I 100% believe that you can be a great founder with not a technical background. So don't view that statement any statement otherwise, right? Like I 100% believe you can be a great founder without a technical background, just to restate. And what you're alluding to, that I've started opening up a bit more to business founders on my end, is again within the realm of technical ventures. I've found that it's actually works pretty well to have tight teams of co-founders where different people do different things. So if you have two technical founders and one person that's less technical, but they have a very strong bond and naturally work together, then I found that actually the business person, having the business person as part of the founding team, has worked a lot better than I thought it might. In the examples that I'm thinking of, those people did have a very strong bias towards product. So I think, again, in the kind of type of ventures I do, having people that are purely business and don't have a natural inclination towards product, I think that's a little difficult. Just being like a sales and marketing person, you know, like I think you need to at least have a very, very deep understanding and excitement about going into the weeds of the product.
Fair. But now we're combining a lot of topics in one because what you said is like a very technical team, and we recently saw a very huge round for a very technical team. So we're combining now the hype cycle of AI, the technical team, the therefore very high price of a seed round. I would say one of the highest ever. I would never say that it's the highest. I'm not sure. But Mistral AI that raised 100 million something on 250 million something valuation. What are your thoughts when you look at what's happening with companies like Mistral AI?
Yeah, that's really got people on Twitter really mad. It was in some ways entertaining. Look, for somebody like me, like I have the benefit of just not being involved with the company. I imagine if you are involved with the company, whether a founder, an employee, or an investor, that must have been profoundly annoying. And it was sort of interesting how strongly people reacted to that. Look, so I haven't met the founders. I do spend a lot of time in Paris. I do know a lot of her founders. I was offered an introduction to the company, but this is very different from the type of investing we do as a firm. By design, because we do early stage investing, we just don't have the fund size to enable us to come in and write a whatever 50 or 75 million check, $7 million check into a brand new venture. So that's not even worth having the conversation. It's just outside of our strike zone as investors. Look, having said that, so I can't really comment based on any kind of informed knowledge about that specific deal. It seems to me to be less crazy than people reacted to. I do think that for certain type of ventures like this one, you do need capital up front. You are going to have to buy or rent a lot of GPUs, a lot of hardware, and that's just the nature of the beast. Doesn't strike me as a completely crazy deal if they, from an investor standpoint, if they sold 43% of the company. It's just basically compressing multiple rounds into one. So now, yes, putting a lot of money in on paper unproven founders because they haven't done it before, at least for the three main ones, may seem crazy, but again, from everything I'm hearing from friends in the Paris ecosystem, it's an A plus or A plus 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 team. Two of the five founders, like I don't know exactly the details of like how things are organized, but are the founders of Allen, which is a very successful company in France. So like at least some people on the team have done it. So look, it makes for very splashy headlines. I don't know that it's necessarily that crazy. And then again, look, if a venture firm on the one hand and founders on the other hand are willing to do that deal and think it's a good idea, like who am I to from the sidelines say whether that's smart or not smart? So that's Mistral. Separately from this, we are undeniably in a crazy hype cycle. You've heard me say before that I have been at First Mark 10 years now, and this is my third AI hype cycle. There was one when I started around 2013, 2014 that was on the back of the resurgence or the acceleration of deep learning post the ImagineNet competition in 2012. There was another one sometime around 2015, 2016, around chatbots. And this is the third one now that restarted, on November 30th, when 2022, when ChatGPT was released. So we are in this, almost vertical part, just going up in the level of excitement. Although I'm starting to sense that things are starting to slow down just a tad bit in terms of level of excitement, largely because I think as a society we cannot sustain this level of attention and intensity for that long. So it's been 6 months, 7 months of just like news every single day, actually several times a day. And I think like everybody's sort of exhausted of the whole like AI, you know, train. So this is, I think, starting to slow down a bit, and inevitably it will die down at some point. Inevitably there will be some kind of like trough of disillusionment. It's always like that. But I do think it's real. I do think the substance behind it is transformative. So it's one of this weird moment where like hype and reality actually sort of aligned. But from an investment perspective and from a company creation perspective, it's a very tricky time, and we can talk about it.
I think one thing I want to state also with the VC topics in the beginning, where I sometimes pushed a little further, and also with Mistral AI, it's not about bashing any of these companies or anyone who's doing anything in the space. It's more trying to get some perspective on things, because it's super hard for people out there who are not involved to understand how the people involved, or at least with some thoughts on it, are thinking about it. Regarding what you mentioned right now with the third hype cycle, the question that I'm thinking about when I would start building in an AI venture right now, obviously I'm not a technical founder, so I would need definitely 1, 2, 3 people who are actually deeply into it. But what are the things that will bring me through such a cycle? What are the companies that ended up surviving the first hype cycle, the second hype cycle? And what do you think are the actual company, like this has to happen, that the company is getting out of the hype cycle without failing, more on the what traits do the companies and the founders have to develop and push forward to also be robust enough to at least have a chance?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because that sort of goes back to the, you know, business founder discussion we were just having. So as obvious as it may sound, the company that successfully made it out of the prior hype cycles actually solved a business problem. And you know, each time, the last two times, it was the same thing. There was a first phase of excitement around the technical capabilities. And suddenly there's like all the things you could do much better, all the things that you just couldn't do before that you were now able to do. So people started dreaming all sorts of different applications. But lo and behold, fast forward a year or two into the hype cycle, you inevitably landed in a spot where it was all about, okay, what problem do you actually solve for me, enterprise who is a customer of that technology, to the point that the websites of the companies in question, the startups in question, you know, early into the hype cycle, we're like, okay, we like AI for whatever, food, gaming, whatever. Fast forward like 1 or 2 years, it's like, okay, no, we solved this problem. And you really had to like look around, you know, fish on the website somewhere to see the mention of AI. So AI goes from front and center at the beginning of the cycle to basically disappearing at the end of the cycle. So I think that's a fundamental truth there, which again, sounds obvious when you stated that way, but like when you're caught into the fog of war, if you want, it's much harder to really do. So solving a business problem first and foremost. And then, you know, in terms of what that means for the teams, that was your question?
Also, yeah.
Also, so look, for an AI venture, personally, I look for the intersection of three things, and that's what I've seen succeed, which sort of like ties nicely like all the prior part of the conversation we've had, I think. One, I do want to see somebody on the founding team that is truly excellent at machine learning and AI, because I do think that for all the hype and all the conversation about AI commoditization, AI remains a deep tech endeavor. So somebody that really, you know, has the background, you know, the kind of people that like read all the papers and are very deep into this. So that's one. to like people or founding teams that have an ability to turn whatever AI into a product. And that's much more a conversation around engineering. That's much more a conversation around software features like workflow and collaboration. And three, I look on the founding team for people that have a natural commercial inclination. Doesn't mean that people need to be natural born salespeople. It means that they naturally thrive on solving customer problems. So on a team of three, I would want to see this. There are very, very rare situations where you can find this in just one person, the CEO. And when that happens, either three, two, or one people that combine the three traits, and you know, it's much rarer than you would think. In my book, that ranks super, super high and makes me disproportionately interested in potentially funding the company, everything else being equal.
What ranks nearly as high in your book? Because you said in your book that these traits rank super high.
So especially at a seed level, that's the number one investment criteria. Then look, I do care about the rest. So you were asking about the traits of companies that make it out. Like, so solving a business problem is one. Look, some level of defensibility certainly matters. I personally think that you know, the conversation around moats is generally exaggerated a little bit. Like anybody else, I prefer situations that are less competitive. Like everybody else, I prefer situations where there is a clear level of defensibility. I do think that you know, very, very few companies actually have a long term moat that's truly defensible. But everything else being equal, yes, if there's a situation where a company has a, you know, unique data set, that's interesting. I do like the concept of data network effects as a potential moat, which, you know, builds over time, but basically means a situation where if you work with a network of customers with one sort of cloud-based machine learning product, over time, that cloud-based machine learning product can learn from all the customers. Obviously, in a way where like all customer data remains private and all the things, but your core algorithm becomes smarter and smarter with just more data, more interaction, more feedback. So, like, I do think that's interesting. So, that's one of the things I'm looking for as well. Combination of all the things. Maybe to close, for an AI venture, I tend to get particularly excited about companies that are trying to solve a problem where AI truly delivers a 10x improvement, for lack of a better term, meaning that typically they do things that couldn't really be done without AI, or are done so much better that the ROI from a customer perspective is just night and day.
I think defensibility could be the word of 2023, because I heard a lot of also pre-seed and seed investors try to dig into defensibility as early as possible, which...
Yeah, you just don't know.
It's super hard. So how do you think, or how do you evaluate defensibility in early stages?
I don't, is the short answer.
Okay.
I obviously like to think about it, but I go into a venture, especially at the seed or rarely pre-seed, eyes wide open that that defensibility may or may not manifest. Like I just said, I think the likelihood of a company actually building a truly strong moat over time, I think that's vastly overblown. There's very, very few companies that actually do that. Some level of a defensibility is certainly like a truly strong moat. I'm not sure, maybe. So I don't sweat it too much at the seed stage. Having said that, like, I think about how crowded a space it's going to be, because look, it's painful to be in a segment that is so obvious that you have like another 12 companies and there's not real differentiation other than better execution. So if I can, you know, finding something that's a little out of the way tends to be more attractive to me, and or finding founders that are so uniquely positioned to do this that they will be able to build competitive advantage but just moving faster. So one of my recent investments, which is unannounced, is sort of an LLM for code kind of company, and it sounds like that's very much not differentiated, but the founders come from a professional background where the very specific code problem that they're tackling, they are very uniquely situated to do it, and they've done it for a long period of time, and the intersection of like solving that coding problem plus their deep machine learning AI background. Basically, there's a number of people in the world that can do that, which is pretty limited. So that's interesting in terms of early stage defensibility.
I like that. I think that's helpful for a lot of founders also to think about how can I think about it. But also, yeah. I think a lot of investors sometimes need to hear that.
I'd add the notion there's a lot of people that seem to think that that whole generation of LLM based applications that do marketing or sales or writing automatically stuff, that those companies are 100% not defensible. And I have a little bit of a different view. And look, I'm not an investor in any of those companies, again, like OpenAI plus X kind of thing. But I just think that the defensibility of those companies will just build over time in the same way the defensibility of a SaaS company does. I think those companies just need more time on earth to build something that's more differentiated, more unique, and they're perhaps more defensible. But that's going to be through features. That's going to be through workflow. That's going to be through collaboration, which I always think is a very interesting way of building, stickiness and some level of defensibility, because you have multiple people at a given customer that work together on a tool, and therefore if you try to take out the tool, they're more likely to protest and fight to keep it. So more time on earth for all those companies. I think the jury's a bit out. We'll need to see if truly they are super easily replicable and if they are not defensible.
More time on earth means hopefully at some point they raise growth rounds. Like, for example, two of your investments, Synthesia and Pigment did. Are growth rounds back already?
So it's an interesting question, and I ask myself that. So look, like those are just two anecdotal points, with a very small N. At the same time, I think that is pretty interesting because both of those rounds were very preemptive. Neither companies were planning on raising. Both of them have plenty of cash in the bank. At the same time, it's funny how this works. Sometimes I look like I've been doing this for a number of years, and I'm still sort of amazed how those processes work. It almost felt like the VC community decided that those two companies were going to do a growth round. And, everybody at the same time sort of like descended on the companies with not just a, oh, I want to learn more, but with a, no, I want to do a deal now kind of approach. And as a result, both, deals were highly competitive. Both companies got multiple term sheets. So I think what's happening is a combination of different things. I think a lot of growth investors have been sitting on their hands for the last 18 months. And, those are people that want to do their job and they want to invest. And it's just extremely boring to you know, not do a deal in 18 months. And as a result, they want to do something. If they are going to do something, then there's going to be absolutely a flight to quality. So both Pigment and Synthesia are considered to be A-plus companies. And they are, you know, super great teams, great traction, great customers, all the things. All of this is undeniable. Like, neither of those investments are like, oh, but this is kind of experimental. Both are businesses that are clearly working. So the question is more, okay, well, you know, at what price, especially if it's a competitive process, can I, you know, tolerate the price and that type of thing? But as it turns out, multiple firms were willing to make this bet. Now, beyond those two companies, what that means for the broader market, we'll see. But it seems that, yes, that the market is surely but slowly coming back. So all of this is subject to whatever happens in the few months. There are, you know, at the macro level, there's potentially a recession, but there's also potentially a soft landing. Nobody knows. We've all been, you know, for the last 18 months trying to figure out what was going to happen. It sort of feels like it could be terrible. That's certainly a possible scenario. It's also sort of, there's also a possible scenario where it could be much milder. So yes, the growth market seems to be coming back pending whatever happens in the macro.
I'll just quote you with the growth market is back. No, I'm joking.
Yeah. Yes.
Last question because of time, but you're from France. You're living in New York for a while.
Yes.
You invest a lot in Europe. What are your thoughts on the European ecosystem compared to the US ecosystem? Because you see and know both.
Yeah, so I'm a huge fan of Europe, and I have been for a very long time. And look, I mean, there's certainly a personal aspect to this, but I like to think that it's you know, simply because it feels less foreign to me. So I've been investing in Europe, you know, pretty much since the beginning of my time at Firstmark 10 years ago. And yes, I mean, it did feel a little different when I first started venturing into the ecosystem. But again, because of, you know, cultural inclination, to the extent that there's such thing as a European culture, never felt just like a fish out of water, just the way some of my purely American colleagues might have. But having said that, like I just think that the rise of the European ecosystem has been just a wonderful thing to see, I think it's just getting started. You know, as it turns out, it takes a couple of decades, sometimes more, to truly build an ecosystem. If you look at New York as an example. So sure, like now New York, especially, you know, in the last year or two, now everybody seems to have agreed that like New York is truly a thing. And look, post-pandemic, there's been like this massive influx of people moving from everywhere, including very much San Francisco to New York. And now New York feels obvious, but New York had been in the making for, you know, 25 years, 30 years, if you think of sort of like the OG success stories in New York. That's companies like, you know, DoubleClick. And we were talking, you know, in 97, 98, 99, you know, so it's been a bit. And, you know, as recently as 1 or 2 years ago, like people were asking me, okay, well, what's, you know, like, is New York truly a thing? Like, you think this, you think there are startups? And like, you know, it's like a million startups and every single VC firm in New York and large successful public companies. But I think the same thing is going to happen to Europe. So if you think about how long it's really been in Europe that you've had tech startups, it's been, you know, arguably 10-ish years. Really, in my opinion, in the last 5 years, you've seen this acceleration of companies, and especially of the kind of companies that truly make an ecosystem. And that means, in my opinion, companies that have global ambitions. You know, it used to be not that long ago, including very much when I spoke to German entrepreneurs when I first met them, you know, 10 years ago, people were still very much in the thinking of, we're going to be in Germany for the first 5 years and we're going to conquer the market. And then it's going to be the DACH, region. And then, 7, 8 years from now, we'll start thinking about the US. But, it's very much like a step-by-step kind of thing. Whereas now in the last 5 years, like the radical thing that changed is that, all the entrepreneurs now, like especially like all the kids, right? Like all the people that are like 1 or 2 years out of school, everybody wants to build a global category leader. And, the reality is that it's now possible. One fascinating aspect of Pigment that we were just talking about is that they are emerging as the category leader for the new generation of business planning software. And they're largely doing it from Paris. So yes, they have a bunch of people in the US and they have a bunch of US customers. But whatever the time, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, the discussion would have been, the founders need to move to the US, like typically to San Francisco. And by the way, you need to incorporate the company as a Delaware company. And that would have been the conversation. And it was like, okay, now that's the way it's going to be if you want to not just raise money from US investors, but truly create a category leader. And now it's like, no, this is a French law company founded by two French co-founders who very much live in Paris. As far as I know, have zero plans to move to the US. And yet they have like all the cool US logos that you can imagine. So I think all of this is really interesting. Now, just to close, having said that, the big obvious question in the European ecosystem is that you need to have exits. And that hasn't really started just yet. There's a real question around whether European companies can go public in Europe. So are the European public markets mature enough from a tech startup perspective? What does a buy side think? And how do those European companies go public on the US markets? So look, it has been done, certainly can be done. I expect it to happen a lot. But for that to happen, you truly need to be a global category leader. So if you look at some of the Israeli companies as an example, like the Wix and everything, they were able to do that successfully. I'm trying to think about the best example, but UiPath and companies like that, I'm thinking of European companies, but they are truly horizontal global category leaders. It's much harder if you have, let's say, a consumer business that's very European-centric that the US buy side may have never experienced or come across. So all of those are real problems that one needs to think through. But anyway, long-winded way of saying I'm super excited about Europe. About 40% of my portfolio is now in Europe or has European roots. So Dedaiku being the perfect example. So Dedaiku being a superb company that's a global category leader for enterprise AI, targeting global 2000 companies, very much a company that started in France, did flip to the US, has been headquartered in New York, a few blocks away from our office for the last 6 years. At the same time, still is plenty of people in Europe with a bunch of like the C-level living in Europe. So it can be done. So Dedaiku being an example. You mentioned Ledger, based in Paris, here in Berlin. I'm a proud investor in Softr, which is a no-code company where I led the Series A. I have two companies in the UK. You mentioned Synthesia. I'm also a private investor in a company called SurrealDB. But again, all of those companies are companies that truly have global ambitions. Like none of them want to build a European champion.
I think not much to add. I would love to discuss like so many things even further, but we have to postpone this to another session. Let's see when I can grab you back into the seat.
Great. Well, this is lovely. I really appreciate it. It's a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate you having me on the podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I'll link to the Mad Landscape, to your blog, to First Mark, to your LinkedIn. or Twitter or both for some memes as well. thanks for stopping by, and thanks everyone for listening to the Unicorn Bakery.